You are listening to another No Fair Remembering Stuff, the Tuesday edition of the Professional Left Podcast, and available wherever you get your podcasts and at our website, proleftpod.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at the Professional Left Podcast, P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
And it's not safe for work.
And today we're going back to the before time to talk about
lovely Rita, meter maid, nothing can come between us.
Specifically, how and why the reign of the Daly family came to an end in Chicago, and what terrible financial shenanigans Richard M. Daly was allowed to get up to in order to hang on to power long enough to outdo his father's record of holding the same office for 21 years. And he did, 21 years. R2-D2, as he was once known, stayed on the fifth floor for 22 years and then got out as the political bills he had deferred had all started to come due.
But first, a word about how politics works from the late, great Dr. Hunter S. Thompson. Quote, "Politics is the art of controlling your environment," unquote. But you know what? You probably haven't heard the full quote from Hunter S. Thompson.
It's important.
It's important. It's from a flyer Thompson posted around Aspen, Colorado, when he ran for sheriff there in 1970. And here it is, quote, "Politics is the art of controlling your environment. That is one of the key things I learned in these years, and I learned it the hard way. Anybody who thinks that it doesn't matter who's president has never been drafted and sent off to fight and die in a vicious, stupid war on the other side of the world, or been beaten and gassed by police for trespassing on public property, or been hounded by the IRS for purely political reasons, or locked up in the Cook County Jail with a broken nose and no phone access and 12 perverts wanting to stomp your ass in the shower. That is when it matters who is president or governor or police chief. That is when you will wish you had voted," unquote.
Absolutely.
Interesting he said Cook County.
Yeah, well, you know, he knows from which he speaks. I believe he was locked up in Cook County with a busted nose.
With a broken nose, yeah.
Yeah, and it really does matter. Now, if you need a short primer on a politician losing control of their environment, I would recommend personally the downhill slide into oblivion of Clarence Royce, the fictional mayor of Baltimore, which took place across seasons 3 and 4 of The Wire. It was a very realistic look at all the angles a big city mayor has to play to hold on to power and what happens when events start to get away from him.
Tony Gray is pulling 24% now. You need new colors and a new message, Clarence. You need to rally the base.
You want me to start wearing dashikis? Go all Marion Barry and shit?
I tell you what I would like. Another 75 in cash for walk-around money.
Now, at the other end of that same spectrum, you have the very real Daly family in Chicago who, between father and son, ran the city of Chicago for a non-consecutive combined 43 years, which is still blows my mind. Mm-hmm. And to get educated on how exactly that system worked under Papa Daly, you must go out and get yourself a copy of the book Boss by the greatest chronicler of Chicago during the 20th century, Mr. Mike Royko.
That's right.
Yep. Hell
the
yeah.
The cover art of the book Boss depicts Papa Daly dressed as a Roman general, towering over the Chicago skyline like Godzilla, and is almost certainly based on a well-known 8-foot-tall statue of Julius Caesar in the Naples National Museum. And while we would never presume to summarize Royko's classic work of ground-level political reportage, to understand what happened to Daly the Younger, it's important to understand how Daly the Elder ruled the city, and why that system began to give way during the early 1970s under the so-called Shackman decrees. And we're going to get to that in a minute. But first, let's let Mike Royko explain how things worked under Daly the Elder. In those days, the Chicago political machine ran on clout and loyalty. And the lubricant that kept the machine running smoothly was jobs. Good-paying city jobs that were handed out as rewards for political loyalty.
Yep.
Here's Mike Royko. Quote, "Nobody in the machine is more family conscious than Chairman Daly. Uncle Martin Daly had a well-paying job in county government that he did so skillfully, he seldom had to leave his home."
Yeah.
That's one of those no-show jobs.
Yeah, there were a lot of those. There were a lot of those. Yep.
Daly didn't come from a big family, but he married into one. So Eleanor Guilfoyle's parents might very well have said that they didn't lose a daughter. They gained an employment agency. Unquote. And everyone knew the rules. Quote, "This town was built by great men who demanded that drunkards and harlots be arrested while charging them rent until the cops arrived. And if somebody in City Hall saw a chance to make a fast bundle or two, Daly wasn't given to preaching. His advice amounted to, don't get caught." Mm-hmm. And of course, if you got caught, he had nothing to do with you and had never heard of you.
Don't even know the guy. Never heard of him.
Going on with Royko, "The first lesson is always the same. Never repeat what you see or hear, or somebody might get indicted."
Mm-hmm.
Unquote.
And all the loyalty flowed upward, right? Yep. All the loyalty flowed to the fifth floor. And Papa Daly controlled his political environment by commanding this vast army of very loyal soldiers and lieutenants, all of whom owed their job to that man on the fifth floor. Now, beneath Mayor Daly, there were 50 aldermen who make up the city council, which theoretically existed to hold the mayor accountable in the strong council, weak mayor system, but in practice were just his rubber stamp. They agreed to anything he put in front of them. Now, a lot of them were low-level crooks and were not too bright, which is why in Chicago we often mark the beginning of spring by an alderman or two or three being perp-walked out of their offices and into the custody of the state. It was a common practice. My favorite is Alderman Isaac Carruthers going to jail for the same crime that his father, Alderman Isaac Carruthers, went to jail for. It was a family business, very dynastic politics.
And there was one alderman who got his office raided by the FBI.
Yeah.
And then they papered over the windows of the office,
right?
Because the FBI was, you know, investigating. And so the office was supposedly shut down. Mm-hmm. And the alderman went back and was still criming, and the FBI raided his office again. Like,
yeah.
He didn't realize that the microphones were still there.
Dude. Yeah. And
like within a 2-week period, this guy's office got raided twice.
One of the quotes I did not include in our post today was from Alderman Dick Mell. And Dick Mell, as you might know, is Rod Blagojevich's father-in-law.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's just, it goes on. That's why buying the book, Boss, is really important, because a lot of the names and the family names in there are still the same. And the machine is very different. It's mostly gone now. But it is a real education as to how things worked on a very, very daily, mundane, practical level, and how Daly controlled the entire state, really. Mm-hmm. He controlled it through Cook County. Why Cook County is this little band of territory around the city of Chicago, how he set up Stroger, the Stroger family in Cook County to look after his affairs, why City Hall in Chicago is two buildings intersecting each other. It's the Cook County offices and the city offices side by side. It's all built to be that way. Now, beneath the aldermen were the ward healers and various local political fixers who were on the payroll in one way or another. They were in charge of things like handing out the Thanksgiving turkeys and the Christmas hams, and they're reminding everyone at election time who it was that was taking such good care of them, and who looking after their kids, and making sure their uncle had a job, and making sure their son stayed out of jail, and all those things. And come election time, everyone was expected to do their duty too. Put up signs for the Daly approved candidates, or, you know, tear down the signs posted by the upstarts who would run against the machine. Get the drunks out of the alleys and the flop houses and the seniors out of the old folks' homes and over to the polls. Get them to the polls on time.
Every day before going to work, Daly the Elder attended Mass at the Nativity of Our Lord Catholic Church, the parish church in the Bridgeport neighborhood where the Daley family lived. And Daley ran the Chicago political machine very much like the Catholic Church, an orderly cosmos where everyone knew their place, where factions either got enough to keep them in line or were familiar enough with the machine's rough tactics not to get out of line. This is from Royko again. Quote, Daley was the most powerful political leader in Illinois history, and with the exception of the president, the most powerful politician in the country. And if a man ever reflected a city, it was Richard J. Daley and Chicago. In some ways, he was this town at its best. Strong, hard-driving, working feverishly, pushing, building, driven by ambitions so big they seemed Texas boastful. In other ways, he was the city at its worst. Arrogant, crude, conniving, ruthless, suspicious, intolerant. He was raucous, sentimental, hot-tempered, practical, simple, devious, big, and powerful. This is, after all, Chicago.
Yeah.
Unquote.
Yep.
But the machine Daley built began to change with something called the Shachtman Decrees.
Yeah, this is really important to understand because the era of big city machines was coming to an end. Daley was one of the last of the machine politicians that ran successfully. And then came the Shachtman Decrees, which started with a guy named Michael Shachtman, who was an independent candidate for delegate to the 1970 Illinois Constitutional Convention. And he filed a suit against the Democratic Organization of Cook County, arguing that the patronage system put non-machine candidates and their supporters at an illegal and unconstitutional disadvantage, which it very much did. This is excerpted from the Encyclopedia of Chicago History. Quote, politicians could hire, fire, promote, transfer, in essence punish, employees for not supporting the system, or more particularly, a certain politician. The suit also argued that political patronage wasted taxpayer money, because public employees, while at work, would often be forced to campaign for political candidates. In 1972, after an exhaustive court procedure and much negotiating, the parties reached an agreement prohibiting politically motivated firings, demotions, transfers, or other punishments of government employees. A 1979 ruling led to a court order in 1983 that made it unlawful to take any political factor into account in hiring public employees, with exceptions for positions such as policymaking. Those decisions, along with companion consent judgments, collectively called the Shachtman Decrees, are binding on more than 40 city and statewide offices, unquote. So, everybody in Chicago knows about the Shachtman Decrees, at least to some degree or another. To this day, in every department, there are some employees who are known as Shachtman exempt. This is stuff you can actually look up online if you want to on the cookcounty.gov website under the exempt positions tab. There is such a thing. They're listed by department and job grade and title. Quote, an exempt position is one that involves policymaking to an extent or is confidential in such a way that political affiliation is an appropriate consideration for the effective performance of the job, unquote.
So, like, if you're the chief of staff of the mayor,
yeah,
it's expected that you're politically loyal to the mayor and are helping him with his reelection campaign.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's straightforward. And I was in management there. I was not exempt, but everyone in management serves, quote, at the pleasure of the mayor, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
The union positions are different, but everybody else is there. And when the mayor doesn't like what you're doing or your boss doesn't like the way you part your hair, boom, you're gone. Now, so in our department, we had a few of these guys. And for example, you knew not to schedule a meeting with Mike the week of the election, because the week of the election, Mike would be around the town doing political work. So Mike would not be at his desk. And that was just, I had never worked in a place like that before. Something I had to get used to, but that's just sort of how the city runs. Now.
So after Shachtman put the kibosh on machine politics as usual, where everybody worked at reelecting the mayor.
Yeah.
The machine died a quiet death and went away forever, right? It was just gone.
It was in all the papers. Machine's gone. Everybody, glorious new day.
Nope. Like many other things, the Chicago machine merely evolved.
It sure did.
After Daley the Elder died, came Michael Blandek, whose career was destroyed by the blizzard of 79.
Yeah, clear
the
snow.
You didn't do the snow removal right, you're out of there.
You're dead. And every politician learned that. Everybody learned that lesson.
Then came Mayor Jane Byrne, who reporters loved because she liked to get into cocktail hour in the early afternoon, say around 2.
2 is good. Let's do 2, yeah.
And she would get very chatty and quotable.
Uh-huh.
But she wasn't up to the job and lost in what was essentially a 3-way primary between her, Daley the Younger, and Harold Washington.
Yeah.
Now, if you're interested, we did an entire podcast on Mayor Harold Washington, who was kneecapped during his first term by an openly racist revolt by 29 aldermen led by Fast Eddie Verdoliak.
Mm-hmm.
The Verdoliak 29 voted as a block, and in the first session of Washington's term, the Verdoliak 29 voted themselves complete control of every council committee. Over the next 3 years, they passed Washington's budget but voted down all of the mayor's proposals. They also voted down all of his appointments, so the appointees could only serve as interim office holders. This was the Daley machine, leaderless but still fighting reform.
And something to remember is that every alderman in Chicago in those days was a Democrat. Everyone, mm-hmm. There was not a Republican to be found. The last Republican mayor was Big Bill Thompson in the 30s under mm-hmm. Al Capone. So these were 29 Democratic aldermen breaking with the Democratic mayor to destroy him.
And because that's how he's black.
Because he's black. No other reason. Simple, simple, yeah. Clear-cut racism. And yeah. Boy, did that put Chicago on the map in the worst way imaginable.
Mm-hmm. Now, in his second term, Washington's candidates won enough seats in council to break the Verdoliak stranglehold. And Washington might have succeeded in genuinely reforming Chicago city government had he not died of a heart attack just 7 months into his second term. And you talk about conspiracy theories.
Oh, man.
When he died, so many people thought, the Verdoliak 29 killed him.
They killed him. The machine killed him.
Some CIA guy killed him.
Yeah.
He
was a threat. He was a threat to the system, and they killed him. And it was pretty common. I think I remember my mom asking me to get home as quick as I could because Chicago was going to be a very dangerous place to be for the next few days. And it was raucous. And there were fights, but it didn't get completely out of hand. But it was tragic because he really was like the last best hope of reform politics.
Mm-hmm.
And the weird thing was he was a machine politician. He was a loyal machine politician. And it's just that when he finally got his shot at doing something amazing, he took it and he was really good at it. And I still have my Harold Washington.
Well, and he just wanted what the machine was giving white Chicago for black Chicago to get their share.
Divvy everything up evenly and fairly.
Yeah.
And
black Chicago should have good roads and good trash collection and
good
job
school.
Opportunities.
Yeah, all this stuff. And,
the Polish, Italian,
Irish
especially.
My people too, yeah. Yeah,
said, all of them said, no. So after Harold Washington died, David Orr served as interim mayor for about a week. Then the city council elected Eugene Mumbles Sawyer. Mumbles?
Yes, Mr. Mumbles. He's mumbling.
To serve out the balance of Washington's term. Sawyer was an agreeable non-entity who managed to accomplish a few notable things while in office, but there was an unmistakable sense that he was a placeholder, there to keep the chair warm until Chicago could elect another Daley.
Yeah, there's always another Daley on deck waiting for their chance. Because remember, Richie Daley, Daley the Younger, ran against Harold Washington. So he was ready. He had the same problem with the English language his dad did. he wrestled it to the ground and would lose 3 out of 5 matches. But he learned politics at his papa's knee. And so he was elected. This is exactly what happened. Daley the Younger, he easily won the Democratic primary and beat Tim Evans and Fast Eddie Verdoliak, yes, the same Eddie Verdoliak, in the general election. Evans was running as the candidate of the Harold Washington Party. Yes, there is a Harold Washington Party and a Socialist Workers Party and a bunch of cool smaller parties in Chicago. And lifelong machine Democrat Eddie Verdoliak ran as a Republican. So,
oh my God,
welcome to Chicago. Where
they had all become, we talked about this in our earlier podcast, the Harold Washington podcast.
Yeah,
that Eddie Verdoliak and his white resistors to the Harold Washington regime They all became Republicans overnight.
Well, they didn't become Republicans by registration, but they backed Bernie Epton, who was the Republican candidate.
Yeah.
Before it's too late. Yeah. And because Chicago and racism and all those things. But however, with Shachtman in place, Daley the Younger didn't have access to that huge political army that his father had. So he began figuring out different ways to hold on to power other than using brute job force. And the most important lesson in power politics, in controlling your environment, was the one he learned at his father's knee in their Bridgeport bungalow, which was never allow any political opposition to take root inside the Chicago city government. Don't allow any power centers to develop inside your own perimeter. Now, to do this, Daley kept his own people constantly on their back foot by scrambling his leadership team every few days or a few years. It felt like days. He built his own cadre of very perky young janissaries, these young interns fresh from the Harris School who were loyal only to him. He gave them imperial authority to bypass city bureaucracy, and they were planted in every department. They'd work there for a year or two and leave with that experience on their resume, and another cohort would take their place, so that there was no line of authority down the chain other than from the mayor to his people in the administration, in the departments. There was no interruption in direct, and they would leave. And it was great, because you'd get this thing on your resume that said you were a special assistant to the mayor of the city of Chicago, and you were 22 years old and full of beans, and it was worth a lot of money to have that on your resume.
Yeah. Now, Daley's management style was, I mean, saying unique is kind of an overstatement. Yeah. He would give his department heads conflicting mandates and then pit them against each other.
Yeah.
And he would hand-pick candidates for aldermen. His entire administration was a case study in preemptively obliterating anything that even vaguely resembles a power base outside of the fifth floor of City Hall. Anytime, if you wanted to have any power, you would be zapped, unless you were serving his honor.
So if you ever, let's say in the future, needed a strong city council to stand up to the mayor, you were screwed because they had all been gelded. It's very much like the case of the Republican Party and Trump.
Mm.
They spent so much time getting rid of anyone who's vaguely rational that along comes the tyrant who can roll right over them, and now they're all personally loyal to him.
Yeah. And don't forget, it's the same with the campaign money, too.
Absolutely.
The person that's raising all of the campaign money in the Democratic Party in Chicago is Mayor Daley.
No. The person who's raising all the money, campaign money in Illinois right now, you mean?
No, I mean during the Daley administration.
Oh, yeah. No. I thought you meant J.B. Pritzker, who is...
No, that's totally different. I'm talking about at the time that his honor, Mayor Daley, was in control of not just the city, but the Democratic Party of Chicago.
Absolutely right. Yep.
If you wanted to run for alderman, you had to have the blessing of Mayor Daley to do it.
Yeah.
And you would have no campaign funding from the Democratic Party of Chicago unless Daley said it was okay.
Yep, absolutely true.
Now, as long as the city budget money kept flowing, the new machine functioned smoothly. Police and teacher strikes could be avoided by throwing money at the problem. Mm-hmm. Friends and allies could be taken care of by making sure that enough city contracts came their way to keep them happy. And if there was a scandal, they'd find a scapegoat. And the whole system was held together by personal loyalty to Mayor Daley. Mm-hmm. Professional fear of Mayor Daley and money.
And money. Most importantly, money. And to keep the machine running, when there wasn't enough money to go around, Daley began to sell off public assets. These were called long-term leases, but when Daley leased the Chicago Skyway for 99 years to a private equity company in exchange for $1.83 billion in upfront money, no one in the world believed that road would ever come back under Chicago's control. There's the director of Chicago Kent College's Center for Open Government said, quote, "The idea that we'll get it back in 2104 is like saying that Native Americans are going to get Manhattan back in the year 2500, unquote. Never going to happen. And that sale proved to be a boon to private investors who bought it, because the Skyway is a toll road. And the minute they signed the deal, they began to jack up the prices of the tolls. In 2004, car drivers paid $2 to use the Skyway. It's a 7.8-mile stretch shortcut into Indiana. It's very convenient. $2 per car. Today they pay three times that. And if you drive a rig that has more than two axles, it's way higher than that still.
But Daly needed fast cash right now to plug holes in his budget, so the Skyway went on the auction block.
Mm-hmm.
99 years. Think about that.
Yep.
It was followed by the parking garages under Grant Park and Millennium Park.
Uh-huh.
And then came the Great Recession, 2007, 2008. And even though the shockwave from the recession wouldn't be felt by the public right away, city budget analysts could see their budget and revenue projections for the next few years going right off a cliff. So mm-hmm. Daly needed money fast. And having spent his 20 years in office assembling a city council that was weak, toothless, and beholden to him for their political lives, what happened next should not have come as a surprise.
Nope. The city of Chicago sold off its parking meter franchise to private contractors for $1 billion in change. The deal was cut secretly, hurriedly, almost frantically, and for a fraction of what the meters are actually worth. And instead of allowing a decent fig-leafing interval to pass to allow the mayor to get all red-faced and pretend he didn't know nothing about that parking company deal, instead they jacked the rates through the roof before the ink on their sweetheart contract had even dried, thus thoroughly fucking over the very citizens on whose behalf this deal had allegedly been rammed through and stranding City Hall without a plausible alibi. So where in the hell did an elected official ever get the idea that he could hawk public assets for a quick buck in the first place? Because that's all this was. That's all this was. Boosting something that the taxpayers of Chicago had already paid for and fencing it like a hot car.
Outsourcing public services sometimes makes a ruthless kind of sense, but only when those services can be provided to the citizenry more efficiently and at a lower cost by a private provider. But a parking meter isn't some high-end web design project or complex social program. It's a pure revenue generator already that really doesn't cost the city a lot. It's parking meters.
Mm-hmm.
An iron box that exists solely to move money from your pocket into the city's coffers. And without a coherent ethical framework or theory of government, the prudent outsourcing of a few services quickly becomes a mindless, piecemeal fire sale of every damn thing in a desperate rush to raise quick cash, which is exactly what happened. And I think while we're tossing around these numbers, Driftglass, of, you know, $1 billion for the Skyway and $1 billion for the parking meters and $1 billion here, it's important to remember the city of Chicago today has a $10 billion a year budget.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge.
It's huge. And so these $1 billion were plugging holes mm-hmm. that were, you know, about one-tenth of what was actually needed to run the city.
Yeah. And that's the difference, because if you fall below a certain threshold, you can't keep contracts going to your friends, and you can't keep
Your uncle in a no-show job on the payroll. Right.
And you can't keep the teachers' unions happy, and you can't keep your promises to the police and the water department about the union contracts you cut with them.
Right.
And you start asking for givebacks, and that's when things start to spiral out of control. In my case, layoffs happened across departments. My department, our budget doubled. Because this, the crisis of the recession was an unemployment crisis, and my department dealt with unemployment.
And your job was to get other people jobs.
Right. So suddenly we had, under the American Investment and Reinvestment Act, Adjustment Reinvestment Act, I forget exactly what it was called, but it was a lot of money, and it had to go through our department. So we had a bunch of work to do, but the mayor announced that we're going to share the pain. All departments are going to share the pain. What that meant was there's going to be a whole bunch of people from departments where the revenue really is dropping who are politically connected. And I need some place to put those people so I don't break my promise to them that they will have a job as long as they're loyal to me. So they went throughout the city looking for job titles and salaries at a sufficient level that their friends could be moved to those jobs effortlessly. And people like me could be gotten rid of because we have no political patronage or friends in City Hall. And that's exactly what happened. They shuffled a lot of people out at my level to make room for the politically connected give them a soft place to land. Now,
and eventually they eliminated your department because those people had no experience in workforce development.
I know. It's a longer story, but
yes.
If you go looking for my department now, it no longer exists. It just vanished beneath the waves. Again, you got rid of me. A few years later, my department disappeared. Yeah, cause and
it's
effect.
Mark Twain all over again. Civil War. Yes, yeah. Yes.
Now, this specific deal was sold to the public as their government creating this rainy day fund that would protect them, be a buffer for the public against hard times, and this buffer would last decades. They'd be protected from hard times for decades. Instead, the Daley administration spent it almost to zero over just a couple of years. It was all gone. It all went away. This is from the Chicago Reader in 2009. The article is entitled "Fail Part 2, $1 billion, new evidence suggests Chicago leased out its parking meters for a fraction of what they're worth." Quote, "In April, the Reader documented how the Daley administration hid its process for privatizing the city's parking meters from the public and the city council. Now, 3 months into the deal, the city still won't explain how it determined what the deal was worth, and new evidence suggests that the taxpayers were hosed out of billions of dollars." DePaul professor H. Wood Bowman, an expert in public finance who in the early 90s served as chief financial officer of Cook County, says the idea didn't make much sense to him. This is quoting Professor Bowman. "The argument in favor of selling public assets is that a lot of the assets aren't tied to the core functions of government, or that there are cost inefficiencies associated with them. Parking policy ought to be a core function of the city, and there are no appreciable operating efficiencies to be gained there. It only costs the city a couple of million dollars a year to run the entire system." By their own admission, most of the aldermen at the meeting had not seen the proposed contract, but it probably wouldn't have clarified matters. Even without this information, the city council that Daley assembled piece by piece over the last 20 years voted 40-5 to approve the deal, and within weeks, Chicago parking meters as much as quadrupled hourly rates at meters all over town, igniting outrage among motorists, unquote.
And it gets worse. This is from Chicago's PBS station, WTTW, July 2nd, 2023. That's this year.
Uh-huh.
Quote, "But wait, there's more. If the city takes a parking space out of service for, say, a street festival or to build a protected bike lane, it has to pay the private company that now operates the meters for the lost revenue. So now the landlord is paying the renter." Plenty of people have searched for loopholes that would allow the city to break this almost comically lopsided lease. No dice. The courts have called the deal foolish, short-sighted, or worse, but it turns out it's not illegal to strike a bad deal. Mm-hmm. With some 60 years left on its lease, Chicago Park Meters LLC has already made back its initial investment, which, to remind you, was $1 billion plus, and then some, unquote.
Absolutely criminal. Absolutely criminal. But even the parking meter cash was not going to be enough. So Daley mustered all the political clout he had and decided to make a bid for the 2016 Olympics. He even got Barack Obama to come back to town to help him make his pitch. Of course, everybody knows by now that Olympic Games are almost always fiscal disasters for their host cities. But like the parking meters, being awarded the 2016 Olympics could be parlayed into a short-term financial boost for the city. And by the time the bill came due, Daley and his people would be safely retired. This is from ABC News, July 6, 2016. Chicago lost the bidding war in the first round, and guess what? It's still paying for it. Quote, "In 2 weeks, Chicago would be hosting the world if it had won its bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics. Instead, the city lost to Rio de Janeiro, which some are saying is a victory in and of itself. The Rio's government has declared a, quote, state of calamity, a financial emergency ahead of the Games. A promised subway line isn't complete. There are major concerns about crime and health. It could have been Chicago. In 2008, there was enthusiasm in the city, and even the newly elected President Obama campaigned on behalf of the bid. That energy and enthusiasm would be snuffed out in a stunning first-round defeat just months later. The bulk of Chicago's Olympic bid was paid for with private money, and Mayor Daley promised no taxpayer money. But there was one glaring exception that remains an eyesore to this day, the Michael Reese Hospital campus. The campus would have been an athlete's village if Chicago had won the bid. The city hasn't been able to sell it in the past 8 years. Mayor Daley put taxpayers on the hook for $91 million, and it won't be paid in full until 2024. So next year, they'll finally pay off the bill for this terrible, terrible idea.
For the Olympic village that was never built and never amounted to anything, and they couldn't sell it. Yep. Unbelievable.
And there was so much movement in City Hall around this whole thing. Mm-hmm. The chief of staff was changed to the woman who was in charge of projects and property. Property developers started flooding into the South Side looking for deals because they knew it was going to be a big thing. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, they bust a whole bunch of us down to the Daily Center in T-shirts to pretend we were a cheering crowd and we were all in favor of this. This was on in the middle of a work day. So it was a full push to get this thing in the door, which we all knew was going to be a terrible disaster. But
yeah, it was going to really hurt the city to have to fund and host the Olympics. It's not, yeah. It doesn't pay it for itself.
No, but in the short term, it might have been worth,
and
you know,
for real estate developers, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then on September 7th, 2010, Daley announced, this is the younger Daley, that he would not be running for re-election for, quote, personal reasons, unquote.
Yeah.
This was a genuine political bombshell that got headlines in every major newspaper in America, that a Daley would leave the fifth floor in any way except on a stretcher with a toe tag was unheard of.
Yep.
But the money was gone. And there were no more billion-dollar financial tricks left to play. And the near-term future for Chicago was beginning to look like this. And this is from the local ABC affiliate, quote, City of Chicago threatening layoffs. Union leaders now say they expect the City of Chicago will send layoff notices to as many as 1,100 workers.
Yeah, which was unheard of. Absolutely unheard of. Yep.
And from ABC News in 2009, Chicago public schools to lay off 1,000 people by the end of summer. 500 to get pink slip now, 500 later on. This was a political environment that even a Daley would not be able to control. And so having hung on just long enough to beat his father's record, remember, I'm gonna be here for longer than 22 years, because then I've beat my dad's mayoral 21. Term.
Yeah, 21, just make it to 22 and out.
Yep. He retired along with most of the rest of his team.
Yeah.
Because they worked for Daley, not for the city.
Yeah. And some of them went to the parking meter company and worked there.
Oh, God.
A lot of them got jobs in investment banking. The funniest one was, I got to say, Ron Huberman, who was Ron Huberman set up the 311-911 center, the giant surveillance center in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And then came the hired truck scandal, which we'll do some other day. And Daley needed a fresh face, a nice looking guy who looked like a Marine to stand out front and take the hit for him and say, this is my clean cut guy. He'll figure it out. So he promotes Ron Huberman to chief of staff. And Ron Huberman gets out in front and protects Daley, you know, throws himself on that grenade and protects him. Then Ron Huberman's made the head of the Chicago Transit Authority because he's going to clean up that. And he was there for about a minute. Then he was made the CEO of the Chicago Public School System.
Yeah, and he said that it was his lifetime ambition to be in the head of the Chicago schools.
I've always dreamed of this. This is the job I've been waiting for my whole life. The Daley announced he's retiring.
No one believed him.
And boom, he's gone. He just vanishes like a fart in a firestorm. Now, that's because the currency of Chicago was clout. And clout only works when the man on the fifth floor is named Daley. And he can back up the currency of clout with his own political war chest, his own favors and so forth. Once that clout is removed from the picture, all the people who owe their jobs to that clout scatter. And they did. Now, there is one interesting postscript to this story of a big city mayor taking his golden parachute and leaving once the money runs out. And that is
wanted to say before you start that story that while we were researching this show, I had to ask Google about 2009 layoffs.
Yeah.
And it is a PTSD sewer to go through that.
Believe me.
And I know you know that because you were personally affected and our relationship began in that environment.
Yes, it did.
Our podcast began in that environment.
It did.
And I looked at it and I was just like, you can't, I don't know why, but I think horrible economic tragedies like that, we allow them to fade from our memories because it's too painful to relive it.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I showed you an article today about how inflation is receding. In October, inflation receded. It's like, oh, what are we going to do? War on Christmas? Because if they don't have inflation to bitch about, what are they, you know, what's going to happen? And the fact is, you have to remember how bad it was, not just in 2009, but in 2020.
Yeah.
When we were trying to get out of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump and the Republicans were doing nothing about it. They'd done their tax cut for billionaires, and they were not willing to invest anything in the United States of America or in the working public.
Nope.
And so I just ask people, I know it's hard to go back to a time when you were without a job, but man, remember how bad it was and who helped climb out of that. It's always Democrats.
It absolutely is. Yeah. And I mean, if I were, I would be the perfect test case for being a MAGA Republican.
Absolutely. And because a lot of your cohort was at January 6th.
Right.
And they lost their jobs and they in 2008, 2007, 2008, 2009, lost everything, lost their house. And what did they do? They started their own business.
Sure. Yeah.
And bought a gun.
Yeah.
And their manhood became, Donald Trump is going to save me.
Well, you know, it was 2008.
Yeah.
And I found out that I was being laid off thanks to a copier accident because they left the org chart on the copier. I found out the same week that Barack Obama won the election. I was laid off the same week Barack Obama was inaugurated.
Yeah.
And so I had every reason to blame Barack Obama for my fate because that's how stupid people think.
Yep.
He got into office. I lost my job. I couldn't find a job for 2 years. And, you know, I lost everything. I lost my condo, lost my savings, lost my health care. I had the love of a good woman, which really, you know, made it possible.
Yeah, that softened the blow a little bit. But we lost when I went and told the food stamp people that we were married.
Yeah.
The guy behind the desk said, so you two are really married, right? You're like not living together. You're married because you're about to lose your food stamps because his unemployment check is too high.
Yeah.
And I looked at him just stunned. Like, are going to kick us for getting married. He said, I'm sorry, but that's the case.
And I get really mad when people talk about how easy unemployment is and living off the fat of the land. Like, first of all, the Illinois limit is like a pittance and you have to look for work. And if you can't show that you looked for work 6 times this month, then you're cut off. If you lie about it, you're not only cut off, but you have to give back all your money. It is a rigorous thing to be unemployed in Illinois and almost anywhere. And it was hopeless. I mean, lots of people my age and my skin color lost their jobs for the first time in their lives. And there were thousands of people lining up for one or two or three jobs all over the country. There were suicides.
Well, and you went to the job center because you did have to prove you were looking for work. So you went to the job center.
I did.
The guy at the job center said, yeah, there are no jobs.
There are no jobs.
I'll sign your paper saying you looked, but there aren't any jobs.
But that and the guy and the administration that dug us out of that.
Yeah.
Was the guy that the Republican Party spent 8 years screaming about and had the same kind of racist meltdown that the Dole Act 29 had. They hated the fact that Barack Obama was president because he was black and from Chicago and was a Democrat.
Exactly.
And they went ballistic. They were not interested in helping us at all. They were not interested in saving the economy at all. Mitt Romney said basically, fuck the auto industry.
Fuck the auto industry. Exactly.
And I had come
Donald
out of
Trump said that too. Let it fail. Yeah.
Well, and I had come out of my specialty was manufacturing, workforce development. Mm-hmm. I knew how many millions of more jobs would be lost in the auto industry and in the surrounding industries and in the knock-on industries if the auto industry failed.
Yeah.
And Republicans didn't give a shit about that.
They didn't care about Akron, Ohio. and tires.
Detroit.
No, they did not.
And as we were crawling out of the bitter end of the Great Recession and getting back on our feet, that's when Republicans started screaming about deficit spending. They remember during the recession, they wanted to cut everything, cut all the spending. Up until Barack Obama put his hand on the Bible, deficit spending was fine. The minute the black man took office, suddenly deficit spending was the end of the world. And so the Republican solution during the recession, when you needed government spending to keep the economy from completely collapsing, they were proposing cutting everything.
Yeah.
Because deficit spending was bad and deficits are bad. The minute Obama's out of office.
The other thing that no one remembers about that era was all of those people who abandoned their McMansions.
Yes.
And just left because they couldn't, you know, they were mortgaged to the hilt and they couldn't pay for anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Moved back in with mom and her Social Security check.
That's right. They sure
and
did.
And that Social Security check kept a lot of people fed.
It did.
During 2009, 2010. It
that
really
socialism.
Did.
That socialism.
Kept children's saved. Shoes on.
It did. It absolutely did. Yeah. And I was lucky to be able to sell my condo for, I made like $50 profit on it. I made enough for a happy meal.
You and I were talking about that, oh my God, you didn't actually destroy your credit.
No, it's amazing.
And a lot of people did. A lot of people we know personally, you know, went back to clean out their house and the sheriff had nailed the door shut.
Yeah.
I mean, it's horrible to think about.
Mm-hmm. So you crawl out of that wreckage and you get to the end of 2016 and the Republican Party nominates the king of the birthers and elects him.
Yeah.
And you wonder why we say we will never forgive the Republican Party or Republicans or, frankly, a whole lot of our brand new allies who were during that time on Team Evil, who were, in my point of view, stomping on me while I was down. Who were supporting people who were trying to destroy us while we were down.
And
there's a whole lot of penance I want to see them do before I trust them. But getting back to the Daley administration.
Yeah.
At a specific time, I was mentioning that, you know, the story of the big city mayor who takes his golden parachute and leaves is a little misleading because the money didn't actually all run out. Because there are these things called tax increment financing districts, also known as TIFs. And Chicago has a lot of TIF districts. And TIFs use the increase in property taxes that result from new development to subsidize that development. And you know what? Sometimes TIFs have legitimate uses. But what it means is once the taxation in that district reaches a certain limit, any taxes above that are put into a totally different fund. They're not spent on schools or roads. They're put in someplace else. But in 2009, as the city of Chicago was cutting services and laying off staff because it said there was no money, somebody noticed that the city was sitting on a whole lot of unused TIF revenue. How much? Well, we turn to Progress, Illinois, June 8th, 2009. As layoffs loom, Daley sits on a $1 billion TIF surplus. Oh my God. This is a quote from Progress, Illinois. Over the past month, Mayor Daley's tax increment financing TIF system has attracted some much-needed scrutiny. First came the news that the city was forking over $3.8 million to insurance giant Willis Group Holdings to refurbish their swank new Sears Tower headquarters, despite the fact that the company's annual revenue exceeded $2 billion.
Yeah, and it's not Willis Tower, it's Sears Tower.
Yes, Sears Tower, damn it, and always will be. Then we learned from the Sun-Times that condo owners in Chicago's University Village had benefited from TIF subsidies only to flip their quote-unquote affordable housing for a profit, essentially pocketing those taxpayer dollars.
Wow.
Cook County Clerk David Orr recently summed it up well. Quote, "We're looking at massive abuse. TIF can be a good tool, but this has become a giant slush fund in the city of Chicago," unquote. Progress, Illinois continues, quote, "While we could write on and on about the massive abuse of TIF, we're going to shift the focus today slightly to the hoarding of unspent TIF dollars. During a city council finance committee hearing last Monday, Chief Financial Officer Gene Saffold and Community Development Commissioner Christine Raguso found themselves on the hot seat as a handful of aldermen demanded some long overdue answers about how the $500 million in annual TIF revenue, along with the proceeds of the city's parking meter, Skyway, and parking garage leases are being managed, unquote.
Huh. Where'd all that money go, in other words? Yeah.
What's actually going on with that? Because nobody was paying attention, because it's daily. You know, it's daily. Yeah. It's him doing it. Now, why not put that billion in TIF funds back into the city's general revenue? I don't know personally the answer to that. I'm not sure, but I do know this, that when I was pitching my team's Wi-Fi project to one alderman, it never got anywhere because City Hall was against it and the city's tech department was against it. And it was, if you do it in one ward, you have to do it in all the wards, and then we're going to start a war. It was typical city bullshit.
This was to have municipal Wi-Fi available throughout the city.
Yes, and we wanted
to test it. Instead of letting, Xfinity or someone sell it to everybody,
We had a solid proposal that kept coming back to life because they kept, every few months, they'd pull it out of the municipal library and call us back in and say, how did you plan to fund this? And we'd explain it. They go, okay, and send us away. So I kept seeing our proposal popping up in other people's good ideas over the course of the next 5 or 6 years. But we wanted to run a test case in one ward, and we found the perfect ward. We thought it had the right mix of rich and poor and high and low, and it was just in the right place, etc. So we approached that alderman, who told me that he could underwrite the entire thing for his ward because he was sitting on $25 million in TIF funds that he could do with whatever he liked. He could spend it any way he wanted. And I got the idea, and it was not exactly unsubstantiated. The TIF funds were considered the personal piggy banks of various aldermen and various department heads.
To spend in their districts.
To spend as they wish. So this was not something you could just raid and take away, because that was one of the things that was keeping them loyal to City Hall.
You couldn't just take it all and put it in general revenue because those 50 aldermen saw that as our personal money.
Well, that would be like Harold Washington trying to redistribute city resources fairly.
Right.
And we don't want to do that. I'm a king in my own kingdom. And again, that's one of the ways that Daley held on to power. There should be 10 aldermen in Chicago. That's
right. You've said that 50. Many times to me. That 50 is ridiculous.
And 50 aspiring, aggressive, arrogant young princes.
Fiefdoms.
And they all think of themselves as future mayors. So they all fight among themselves and they leave the mayor alone, which is exactly the way Daley wanted it.
That's how Daley wanted it. Yeah. I remember at one point there was some sort of event in Chicago and one of the aldermen didn't get preferential seating at the event.
Oh, yeah.
And it was front page news the next day in the Chicago Tribune.
She went ballistic.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Yeah.
How dare you?
Yeah.
And there was I was there the day the Walmart hearings were being held, and there was one young alderman who had approved Walmart construction in his ward, which is fine, right? Two old dogs, old bulls, tore him to shreds on the floor of the city council and educated the young man that this is not how we do things in Chicago, because your ward is adjacent to my ward and adjacent to his ward, and you'd have to sit down and get us to agree with you because
to give you permission.
Yeah, because you're putting in something in your ward that's going to take away from ours. So that's not something you get to do on your own, young man. And they really gave him a spanking. And it was free entertainment. I always said the city council meetings were the cheapest free theater available in the city of Chicago. Open to the public anytime they wanted.
Well, I have a question for you, Drift Glass, because, it's clear why the elder Daley wanted to be mayor of Chicago because he had ultimate power. That was his kingdom.
Right.
And the Daley the younger wanted to be mayor of Chicago because it was his kingdom and he was the prince. He's the heir to his dad's legacy and he wanted to live up to that legacy. And that's why he stayed for 22.5 years, right?
He's the prince who was promised. That's right.
Why in the hell does anyone today in 2023 want to be mayor of Chicago?
You got to have an ego.
I mean, Rahm Emanuel was so unpopular.
Yeah.
Lori Lightfoot, I mean, I am surprised that she made it out of there alive.
Uh-huh.
She was so mistreated, so hated, so vilified.
Yep.
And I'm not saying assassination or anything. I'm just saying from the wear and tear of Daley being attacked.
Uh-huh.
Brandon Johnson seems to have a good relationship with the governor. Everybody seems to like him.
There's money.
Because there's federal money coming into the city.
Yeah, there's federal money coming into the city.
And we have a governor with fuck you money who's making sure Chicago is included in the Illinois success story.
Right.
Because it's essential to the Illinois success story.
That's right. So
Chicago is now the hub. There's two hubs in Illinois for economic development and industry and so forth that the federal government is funding.
Yes.
That helps. You've got money coming in. The times are good, but you know, when times are bad, man, I don't understand why people want to be big city mayors. New York City, same thing.
I don't, as a fiction writer, you and I can imagine the gargantuan size of a person's ego.
Yeah.
That's necessary to have them believe that they and only they can seize the reins of this wild, rambunctious city and govern it effectively, rule over it effectively. Mm-hmm. I don't have it in my genetic makeup to do that.
No,
I just can't. It is inconceivable to me. And the way you have to deploy your troops and the number of games you have to play and the number of, I mean, the amount, it's true that Daley the First went to church every morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's not kidding. And he wasn't making it up. He was a real sincere, aggressive,
devoted
Irish
Catholic. Right. Yeah. And he loved his mother.
He loved his mother. He loved his wife.
He didn't cheat on his wife.
No.
He didn't. Yeah. I mean, this was his life, was being mayor of the city, right?
Well, and he was a state rep or senator in Springfield. He stayed away from the poker games. He stayed away from the prostitutes. And he read the fucking budget. He knew where every dollar was and what it was being spent on. He really learned the system inside and out. And he moved up through the ranks. There's a thing, I don't know the name of it in Latin, but it's the course of honors.
Mm-hmm.
It's how Romans rose to power in Rome. You had to go through certain offices to get to the top. And Daley worked his way up from, you know, a foot soldier all the way to mayor, because that's what you do. And the advantage both Daleys had is they never wanted to be anything more than the mayor.
Right, right.
That was it.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they knew how the system worked, they knew how to, they read Machiavelli, or they knew it in their bones, so they knew how to control large systems, and they were good at it. You know, they did some terrible things, but they did some pretty good things.
They had a lot of good people working for them who were very smart also. I mean,
yes, they did. And they kept everyone off balance and everyone at each other's throats enough to keep them away from wanting to seize power from the king.
The 50 aldermen with all their little fiefdoms couldn't get a toehold on the mayor's office. No, of course not.
There's lots of stories about, you know, big city mayors and big politicians. There's some about that big chair and some about being able to breeze through traffic and wave through airports, and people know who you are, and people want your autograph, and everybody wants a favor, and you are the center of attention everywhere you go, that some people find irresistible.
Yeah.
I do not. It's important to remember this. We don't have TIF funds for this podcast.
That's right.
There is no billion-dollar slush fund. The only assets I could sell off are maybe my shoes and this old computer. So we're not able to sell public assets to support this podcast. What we really need are more Patreons to make this podcast fly. So if you can spare $5, please spare $5 and visit our Patreon at patreon.com/proleftpod. And thank you so much for doing that.
See you next time.
See you next time.
The Professional Left Podcast, No Fair Remembering Stuff Tuesday edition, is produced under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2022-23, DGBG Productions.